Hi, it's good to have your company. My name is Simon Smart and you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Well, there's a growing sense that while in the West we might be materially rich, increasingly we are impoverished when it comes to community and relationships. Well, someone who thinks there's a great need to improve this situation and is actually confident we can do something about it is Michael Schluter. Michael is an economist. He's the chief executive of Relationships Global. You'll see his name attached to Relationships Forum Australia and organisations like the Jubilee Centre in the UK that he set up in 1983. That's a Christian social reform organisation offering a biblical perspective on issues and trends relevant to the general public. He's an author. His recent book is After Capitalism, Rethinking Economic Relationships. We'll get to that in a little while, but welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Yep, nice to be here.
Great to have you in. Now, much of your work is looking at building relational capital. What do you mean by that?
Well, relational capital is about the stock of relationships that we have in our relational bank account and about how we build that. And that's partly about how we spend our time. Because every time we spend time with somebody, we're building relational capital with them, or usually we are. We might be destroying it, of course, if we're having an argument, but generally we're building it. So the big questions about who we spend time with. But it's also about, I like to talk about relational pensions. So people are building a financial pension, a stock of capital for when they retire. We're suggesting people should consciously and deliberately build a relational pension where they invest time and sometimes money too in building relationships with key people who'll be around when they retire. So you don't get to retirement and you look around and say, oh, well, who am I going to relate to now? You've actually got a stock of friends that you can relate to at that time.
Now, you challenge people to look at life through a relational lens. What's an example of that? And how might that sort of attitude change the way we do things?
Well, we tend to look at life through an individual lens a lot of the time. So we're talking about individual rights and personal development and all that kind of stuff. We're saying people's relational skills, their ability to relate to other people, how much time they give to that is also very important. And so it's more an emphasis on obligation than an emphasis on rights. So, for example, visiting a GP, you would think about your individual experience. How did it feel going there? But you might also think about the relationship that the GP has with you. Let's think more about the relationships involved here and less around the individual emphasis.
Yeah, so if I'm trying to make a decision around, say, the holiday I'm going to go on or the next purchase I'm going to make, what would be a way I might do that with a relational lens on?
Well, you can go on holiday and think, where am I going to be able to enjoy myself most? What is going to give me the most relaxation, the most fun, the most excitement? And just think about it in terms of yourself as an individual. Or you can think, where can I go that's going to give me the greatest opportunity to build relationships with my partner, my spouse, my children, even my parents, perhaps sometimes, that may take you to a different destination.
We are a wealthy culture, especially in the West. But how do we do on the relational score? And if we're doing badly, in what areas are we doing badly?
Well, you mentioned earlier the idea of relational poverty, effectively. And we're saying that Western countries are experiencing a great deal of relational poverty. It's often expressed in the form of loneliness. So 60 million Americans now saying that loneliness is blighting their quality of life. And I think a third of all Americans over 45 are, quotes, chronically lonely. That is an epidemic of loneliness, and it's relational poverty in our terms. But often relational poverty is also where you don't have a good relationship with yourself. You're not sure who you are, where you fit in the world. Perhaps you have low self-esteem, all of those things. So Western countries are perhaps regressing, going backwards in terms of their relational development and have high and growing levels of relational poverty.
Now, you've worked in this area for a long time, decades, thinking about this, writing about it, forming organisations, trying to improve things. What motivated you in the first place to get involved, and how much did your Christian faith play a role in that?
I got interested in this issue when I was working in East Africa in the 1970s, so we are talking a long time ago. You can tell how old I'm getting. I got involved in it because I was dealing a lot with students at that time, and we had Marxism in Ethiopia, we had socialism in Tanzania, we had capitalism in Kenya. And the question is, what is a response as a Christian to that? So I was a Christian, I was working among students, and they were asking me this question with a degree of urgency. And as I got into thinking about this, I realized that Christianity didn't really endorse any of those ideologies. So what would be the starting point for a different ideology? So I started studying the Bible, actually, Old Testament material, which is common with the Jews, of course, and realized that the heart of that thinking is around the notion of love. But then I thought, how do you bring love into public policy? You know, if I go down to my World Bank office on Monday morning and I say to the guys down there, look, we're looking at compulsory villagization in Tanzania at the time, you know, the solution to this is love, they'll think I've gone back to flower power in the 1950s.
Right, so you had to find a different way of expressing that.
I needed to find some other way of thinking. And then I realized that love is about relationships, and that actually all of these areas of public life, public policy, in the end are about relationships. Doesn't matter if it's about education or health policy or whatever. Underneath everything, there is a set of relationships. So I then got into the field of thinking about relationships and public policy and thinking about how the way we use money and finance particularly influences the way people relate.
Now, you've mentioned your Christian faith and then trying to find a language for how some of those concepts that you take from your faith can apply to a public setting. How well does this stuff resonate with people, especially people who aren't believers?
Well, I think everybody's got relationships. I ran a campaign on the Sunday issue in Britain. Should we deregulate Sunday shopping? It was a big proposal of Mrs. Thatcher's. And MPs had more letters on that single issue in the 1980s than on any other issue. Why? Because everyone has a view of Sunday shopping, right? We all are legitimate experts on the issue of whether there should be Sunday shopping. So if you come to the issue of relationships, this is something we all know about, we all engage with. In a sense, every one of us is an expert. We've all had experience which is unique and special, and we have something to say. So when you say Christianity is fundamentally about relationships, it's a relational religion in a sense, and if you say it has something to say about personal relationships, but also organizational relationships in companies and schools and hospitals and prisons and wherever, then people say, okay, that's interesting. I've got relationships. I'm in a business. I'm in a hospital. I'm interested in the relationship issues. Talk to me about it. So it does resonate.
Yeah. Now, you've identified key areas in which to promote relational thinking, family, community, government, businesses, and so on. Let's stick with family for a moment. Why is that such a crucial area?
I think from a simple human point of view, our deepest and longest relationships are with members of our family. You just can't get around it. I mean, many of us struggle with our family relationships. I don't think anybody would say they find family relationships easy. And probably none of us would say that we had perfect relationships. At least I hope we would recognize we haven't got perfect relationships. So we all struggle with it. But at the same time, we realize that in 30 years from now, if we're still alive, it's likely to be the family members who are still around. Some of the friends will be, but some of the friends will disappear off the stage. But for most people, for most of their lives, the family relationships end up being either the most important or close to the top of the list.
And it has a massive bearing on your well-being, doesn't it? If your family relationships are going well, the alternative, of course, is terrible.
Yeah, I remember talking to a guy who measures well-being for a livelihood down at the University of Melbourne, and he said, you know, the most important determinant actually of people's quality of life and well-being is the quality of these close family relationships. It ends up being just very, very high on the index.
What do you think are the best ingredients or the key ingredients of a healthy community?
We meet as many people today in a week as a medieval person met in a lifetime. Just try and get your head around that. And I think the reason that people had these close relationships in villages in the past, and sometimes they were toxic, but by and large people did learn to rub along with each other, was because they had long-term relationships. They got to know each other from a broad point of view. They saw many different sides of people's lives. And they had a sense of common purpose. We've got to live together in this village. We've got to defend each other. We've got to feed each other. All of those things were important.
Now let's talk about your book, After Capitalism. We'll sort of narrow into that now and focus on that. After Capitalism, Rethinking Economic Relationships. Presumably you're not totally opposed to capitalism.
I'm director of a family company. My son is sixth generation head of the company. It's doing coffee trading from Africa to around the world, I think including Australia from time to time. So I believe in enterprise economy. I believe that we need businesses to run the place. We don't want governments doing that. Governments should stay out of it, as far as I'm concerned, as much as possible. But equally, I believe that capitalism, in the sense that capital goes simply where it gets the highest return with no regard for the relationship between the borrower and the lender, is toxic for a society. That is, we need to link the person who's got the money with where the money is used, and not be all of us as savers with our pensions and the rest of it like absentee landlords who simply take the profit without engaging with where the money's used.
We didn't have evidence enough for this before. With the global financial crisis, we've seen terrible weaknesses in the system. What do you identify as some of the key things to do as we go forward in reforming capitalism from within?
At one level, it's about, for example, allowing all the different stakeholders to come to the annual general meeting of a company. Not just have the shareholders at the annual general meeting of a company, but recognizing that other people make an important contribution. So getting the employees in the room, the suppliers, the customers, and all kinds of other interested parties, the local communities perhaps, if it's a mining company, we think they should be in the room too. That would just be one simple example. And lowering the pay differentials. We think paying the girl on the checkout or the bloke on the checkout 1% of the salary of the chief executive, we just think that that is morally unacceptable and cannot survive. Capitalism needs to reform itself. Maybe a differential of 10 to 1, maybe, you know, 20 to 1 before tax, 10 to 1 after tax. One could cope with that, but 100 to 1 seems to us just way off the beam. So that would be one sort of area to look at.
You talk about relational companies as well. What do you mean by that? What would a company that's following this sort of relational lens look like?
We've suggested the possibility of a relational ratings agency, rather like a credit ratings agency. We put out a booklet. People can find it on the Relationships Global website. It's called Transforming Capitalism from Within. So we've suggested a 10-point charter. This includes the purpose of the company in its objectives and so on, having a relational component. I mentioned the annual general meeting. It's about having long-term stakeholders in the form of shareholders. So shareholders don't just dip in and out through the stock market. How can you exercise responsibility as a shareholder if you only own the share for 5 minutes? You just can't do it. Paying suppliers on time. Not making workers work unsocial hours unnecessarily, realizing that people need to be with their families and recognizing the families of employees as stakeholders as well.
Yeah, this is a big one, isn't it? Because you've identified this as care for the employees as a crucial part of a relational company.
Yes, that's right, and their families. So it is about giving people proper notice of changes in rosters. It's about the number of hours they work. It's about arranging things so that they're not constantly under pressure where they work. Often, perhaps, it's about having shorter meetings. Someone suggested that all meetings in companies, and they practice this in their company, all meetings in companies should be held standing up, 30 minutes.
It'd be easy to be cynical about this, or at least concerned that really people aren't interested in this sort of stuff. They're wanting... And you seem very optimistic that we can do something about this. Does your Christianity have a role in that?
As a Christian, I believe that all people are made in the image of God. And for me, my understanding of God is not some person lost in the sky somewhere far away from us. It's three persons in a trinity of persons in perfect relationship with each other who existed before the world ever came into existence. So we're all made in the image of God. That means we're all relational beings. And relationships are the most important thing to our well-being. So as you talk about relationships and spreading it into every area of public life, people can see the vision of a better world, a better way to live, a happier world than the one we have now, and not to accept that loneliness is inevitable and that misery in old age is something that we have to expect.
Well, Michael Schluter, there feels like a lot of wisdom you've accumulated on that and a great vision that you've set before us. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
No, it's been a joy to be here. Thanks.